Well, Chris, it's always great to have you on my show and, you know, talk about this new Spirits of Fire album and give us a little bit of a background about it and, you know, how this whole record actually came together.
Well, I mean, I've been a friend of Ripper for a very long time, and we met actually on the press tour. It's funny you talk about it. For Wake of Magellan, me and Johnny Lee Middleton were in Germany in Cologne doing a press thing at that thing called PopCom over there, and we were out one night after everything was done. We were in this metal bar, and KK Downing was there with the new singer of Judas Priest, who was Ripper Owens, and I met him for the first time, and we became friends. And you know, I would go to see Priest when they came through New York, and then we wound up on the Poets and Madmen tour, opening up for Priest with Sabotage. And then after that tour was done, Ripper went to do his very first solo record when he was on his own. He asked me to write a song for him, and I did, and I had a song on his record and wound up touring in his band for his solo thing, where we opened up for Heaven and Hell and Ronnie Dio's very last tour in Europe. And, you know, it was just funny things where I love playing with Ripper, and he's such a great singer, and I was just looking for an opportunity one day to do that. I never really was making plans about it, you know, and I was approached by people to do what, you know, they call the project bands or whatever people call it, the superstar bands or whatever people like. I mean, I don't like that word, because then, you know, people sit there and say, oh, you're not big enough to remember or something. I was like, whatever, it's a project band. So people wanted, you know, to put me together with things, and a lot of times it never really attracted me, because, you know, I was always very busy with what I was doing, and I just didn't want to be a part of something that I wasn't really that into. But then when Frontiers called me about this one, it was like kind of odd that they just came out of nowhere with the name of Ripper for it. They were like, oh, we were thinking about getting a band together with you and a vocalist, and we were thinking that you with Ripper Owens would be great, and we could do something with, you know, with that sounded like Judas Priest a little bit in Sabotage. And I was like, wow. And then they mentioned the name Roy Z, and I always loved what Roy did with Halford and Dickinson, but I never worked with him. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, this could be awesome. I can get a chance to work with this guy, Roy Z. I could do a record with my friend Ripper, you know. And of course I knew who the Georgian ones under were, but I never had a chance to work with them. So like, this is going to be a really great rhythm section, and we can make a record. And to me, it was just something that appeared like a fun chance to put something together. I mean, this particular project to me was presented as fun. And I was like, wow, I can kind of replace the, you know, the old feeling I had when I worked with Aleva on Dr. Butcher, where I was just putting together a metal record. And then that's kind of what it was with this. And, you know, and to work with Roy, he was such a great and creative person, and he was a lot of fun. He was a lot funnier than I ever imagined. Not that I didn't, you know people could be funny, because Aleva was probably one of the funniest people on the planet, but Roy Z was just very animated, and I had a lot of fun working with him and getting this together. And a lot of people that I talked to have been really enjoying this record, and I think, you know, the first couple of songs that we put out do have a little more of that Priest and Sabotage kind of sound to it than the actual rest of the record does. And that's, you know, the ones that Frontiers had chosen to have people hear first. But I think as people hear the whole entire record, they're going to hear a little bit more of the personality in it, which definitely has a lot of its own identity. Mm-hmm. And I think people are going to really enjoy it. I mean, I know I enjoy listening to it. A lot of times when you're done working on something, you get a chance to put it back on, and sometimes you won't even make it through the whole record, because, you know, it just kind of loses its charm to you. But, you know, something like this, it was really, really fun for me when I would bring it out and put it in my car, and it would stay in there. You know, I keep listening to it. I'm like, this is a fun metal record. It's just a good, fun metal listen. You know, it's not, I don't think it's going to turn around and being the greatest metal record that's ever been released, but it's a fun metal record to listen to, and I think people are really going to enjoy it.
You know, my first impression of the album, too, it's kind of funny you say that, because my first impression of this record, you know, it's a good album. It's a fun album, like you said, but I did get that nice, fun, laid back vibe from it. And to me, that's what stood out first when I started listening to this.
Yeah. And I think that comes from that element that I was talking to you about. Me and John were very close friends. And even though it wasn't a very long time when I left Sabotage, we wound up working together instantly as soon as he was out of that band. And we just sat you know, and we were staying in one of his friend's house in the middle of nowhere in Florida, and out of, you know, we just started writing, and we had demos that we came up with for this, and then we were just having fun with it. You know, John was talking to his brother and telling him, we're going to put this band together, and we're going to do this thing, Dr. Butcher, and Chris was listening to the demos, and he was just like, you know, I thought you lost this part of your voice. He was getting all mad listening to John singing the high and screaming and this and that, and it was even a point where people don't even really know this, but Chris almost joined the Dr. Butcher thing with us for fun. But, you know, he had gotten Zach into Sabotage, and that had gotten very busy with him before he passed away. I mean, he, you know, Sabotage started to get a really good buzz going on, and you know, commercially they were going to a different level in a lot of their radio play in the States, and unfortunately Chris had passed away on that tour. But you know, that was just a really fun record, and that's kind of with this one. I had that opportunity. I was just like, I just want to make some fun metal music, and I think a lot of people are enjoying it.
You know, it's funny. I listen to your solo albums, and I know you've gotten some flack for singing on them, people saying your voice is terrible and all that stuff. But, you know, to be honest, I really think you do pretty well on them. I mean, I'm not saying you're the greatest singer in the world, but I think what you do vocally actually sounds pretty good. And really fits the music that you are writing, you know, and, you know, it's a solo album, you know, so it's kind of cool to hear you sing as opposed to the typical thing where people get singers on these albums. So, you know, to me, I've never understood the amount of criticism you've had or have received for your vocals on your solo stuff, basically.
Yeah, no, me either. It's pretty crazy, because if I didn't tell people it was me singing, people would listen to it and they were like, wow, I really like the vocalist on this record. Who is it? And I would tell them it's me. And it is really odd how that happens, because I know I'm not the greatest singer in the world, but I'm a lot better than a lot of the ones I have worked with. You know, and I'm a lot better than, and I'm not saying it's a leave or anybody like that, but I've worked. That's, you know, voices were kind of difficult at times, and, you know, and other ones that I went to see, and this, and it was just kind of weird, because I went through so many different kind of octaves and timbres and background vocals and this is and that's, and then, you know, even people with this record, I saw a review where somebody said, well, this is finally, you know, you could hear what something sounds like when Caffrey isn't singing, and I'm just like, well, I didn't really think those. And so I think a lot of it came from, there was such a, it's weird, Sabotage was so loved by a lot of people, and there were so many critically acclaimed things that happened with that band, that when you do things after it, they expect that level of everything you do. So if you're Zach or Oliva, they're really comparing what you're doing vocally to things at that kind of a level. And then I was just trying to make some really fun records and enjoy it. And, you know, it's weird, because I would have that kind of thing where there would be some people saying the vocals sound great, and other people saying the guy can't sing. And I'm just like, this is really mentally pretty amusing, because I would get done with it. I'm like, you know, people wonder why I'm writing the song, like, pisses me off. It's pretty common sense. I mean, it just, you know, it's like, some make up their mind. If everybody said it sucked, I probably wouldn't have sung again. But there's a lot of people, including the fans, that liked it. Uh-huh. So it was just kind of one of these things. I did it for me to have fun, and that was the main reason for me to be singing, doing solo records anyway. I did it as a way for me to have fun. You know, we were very successful with a lot of the things that I was doing on the side. I didn't necessarily want to join a band that I wasn't really into or didn't have a full year working with, where it was just a part-time kind of a band. I didn't really have that desire, like I said, so I just made solo records and made music, and my fans liked it, and it was fun for me. It was fun for me to create, you know, and that was the reason why I did that. And, you know, people are allowed to have their opinions. I've kind of gotten to the point in time in my life where I've had so many crazy things happen. There's been 18 people in my life who are very close to me who passed away in the last 3 years. There's things that are going to bother me hell of a lot more than somebody critiquing, over critiquing or under critiquing or whatever it is, my vocals and my songs and things that I'm doing. I mean, there's a lot bigger things to worry about in this world for me than that. You know, the people that I still have alive in my life are a lot more important for me to pay my attention to than things like that. You know, it's very small in a scale, the things in my life and things that I've been through and things that I'm going through and things that will be coming that I haven't even seen yet. You know, there's going to be more difficult things. I just, like I said, everybody can keep their opinions and do what they want with them. They're allowed to have them. That's the way the world works. And that's the way I look at it.
Well, my point, you know, honestly, Chris, is that if the vocals fit the music, then that's what should be there. You don't have to be the most talented guy out there, but the vocals have to fit the music. I mean, you could put, you know, one of the most technically gifted vocalists on a record, but if that person's voice does not fit what's being produced and what's being written, then realistically, it actually hurts the record. So to me, I think what you do fits your music, and that's why the criticism just, you know, just kind of baffles me.
No, that's the whole thing. If I never, like, said who, if I created a different name, or if I became a singer instead of a guitarist, it probably would have been a very successful say. Hey, I've seen it, and this is mind blowing. Okay, I have seen people cut down Richie Kotzen's voice, and that guy's one of the greatest freaking rock singers on the planet. And I've read reviews and things where people are cutting down his voice and saying he's a freaking Cornell wannabe and this and that. I'm like, Richie Kotzen is one of the best rock voices I've ever heard in my life. to see somebody cutting him down, it really doesn't make me feel that bad, because it's like you just know that somebody's looking at him as a guitar player and saying, oh, well, you know, it's okay. But I mean, that dude's freaking amazing. I am so into what he does as a musician and a singer that I never once thought of anything other than that guy's a great singer. And I would read that and I'm like, oh, yeah, things aren't that bad. I can put Richie Kotzen's freaking vocal critics piss me off, and the next pisses me off that I do. You know, it's like, right, I don't even have to put my own in there, because, you know, I've seen it for other people where there's a guitar player that has a voice like that, then he gets it. And that voice is freaking priceless.
Well, you know, let's talk about working with Roy Z, because Roy has, over the years, really helped develop other musicians that he's worked with. And really, every musician I've ever talked to that has worked with Roy has learned something from him. And, you know, by working with Roy Z, you know, is there anything that maybe you learned by working with him that you can tell us about?
Yeah, you know, I think there was a lot of just what he wanted overall to be able to produce and mix. But I think we had a lot of the same egg going on with that. You know, when he actually, at the end of this record, what he wanted from me is, I had sent him some mixes from my solo records. He wanted me to give him some of the extra tracks, is I did a few extra rhythm guitars on my record, and I only had sent him just normal stereo rhythms for this one. He wanted an additional couple tracks of the rhythms that I did on mine. He's like, so when I thought I was all done, Spirits of Fire for me is like the record that never ended. Uh-huh. I thought I ended it, and like 6 months later, I was going back and doing additional rhythm guitars. And, you know, that was the kind of thing where, you know, we're kind of in the same egg with that. So, you know, it's like, I definitely had a lot of the finishing the guitars that were things that he liked. He always wanted me to add in this extra guitar track that kind of spoke above everything else that he could use. You know, he's just like, just play whatever you want, and I might use all of it, I might use none of it. And, you know, so I was just going and playing over it. But what had happened with this stuff too is, out of the 11 songs on the record, Roy had written 3 of them. And, you know, when he gave me those songs, I was playing the leads on the thing. There's actually a 4th song that we didn't use that I was kind of bummed out, because I think he was using it for Halford or something like that. And I was like, darn it, I wanted that song. But, you know, when Roy played it, he had solos on it, and I knew I had to be doing solos. And I'm like, man, I have to play something that's as good as what that guy did, you know. And that was the thing there, where it was like, he raised my lead playing out to a level to where he was going to get those solos that he was going to really like them. And there was one, I think it was the title track, the song Spirits of Fire, where that was the one where he was like, you know, I've got what I need at every song in the lead things except this one. He was like, I need to get, he goes, I don't know if it's the sound, I don't know if it's played. He says, this one is, when I'm mixing it, it's not doing it for me. So I went back and I think I just took that song, and when I did the additional rhythms on it, I just turned on a guitar and wound up playing just maybe it was like one or two lead tracks, and I just sent it to him, and he was just like, that's it. So I mean, you know, there was like I said, a lot of things where we were very similar, but you know, luckily for me, what he did that I didn't have to do was, you know, was the mixing and getting a lot of other kind of stuff done. He just had a great ear as far as how to make things sonically work, and you know, I like that. And he was a really fun and friendly person to work with. He was so humorous. He would, if you did something and he didn't like it, he had the funniest way of talking about it, because you don't know what to expect. You know, you could talk to people that are famous producers, you go to work with them, and they just come across as really artsy sometimes, and their speaking and their tone of voice and what they say is something that's, you know, could be like, you know, in a Hemingway sort of thing, where they're just like really always very fancy and sophisticated. But Roy Z was this guy with his Spanish accent. He was just a comedian. So it was really fun to work with him. And he didn't like something, it was just very funny. He would have the funniest little anecdotes and ways to describe things. Like if he thought something was bad, he'd be like, dude, no. He goes, you don't get it. He goes, this is baloney, man. And he goes, and I'm not talking like boar's head from the delicatessen. This is like frozen bologna. He's like out of the freezer section. He goes, this is like Oscar Mayer, dude. This is, and I'm just like, where is he coming up with this stuff? And it was funny because he did it for a lot of different things. I mean, it was probably like 30 different times when I was working with him, he came up with these really funny comparisons that had nothing to do with what he was talking about, but he just used them to describe what he was saying, and it always had me dying laughing.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about Tim Ripper Owens, because, you know, here's a guy that's singing on this more of like a hard rock project called A New Revenge. And then you have him going balls out on this Three Tremors thing. And then you have him singing on the Spirits of Fire album, which is kind of more somewhere in between both of these records. And, you know, what's it like for you to work with a very versatile guy like Tim, and, you know, finally to be able to, you know, make a whole record with him?
Well, you didn't really have to think about anything when you were writing. It was just like, I'm going to write this song, and I don't have to worry about what the guitar is tuned like. I don't have to worry about what key it's in. This guy's going to be able to sing something that's going to work. And when he wrote his things for it, he would come up with these ideas, and, you know, maybe something had a little bit of an edge of like David Bowie in it. And it's like, oh, I didn't really even think he would come up with those melodies or those rhythms like that. And he would put lyrics and melodies over parts where I didn't hear is the part with the vocals, and he would come out with these things, and I'd be like, oh, this is really cool. And he just, you know, he was very, very easy to work with, and I'd worked with him before we did stuff. He's just great. And that's, you know, like you said, with those three records that he comes out, I mean, there'll be probably another 10 records that he has a vocal track on one way or another this year. And the reason why he gets that much work is because there are not that many singers that are that good. You know, he's just he's almost a novelty in the fact that he's able to sing all those different kinds of vocals that well, you know, and do what he does. He's special. I mean, when I opened for Priest with Sabotage for 6 weeks, I watched him sing an hour and 45 minute preset every night, and sometimes 6-7 nights a week, and he never missed a note, and that wasn't easy.
No.
And I've seen him do the Dio Disciple shows on his own, and I've seen him do some with other singers, but I've watched him do, you know, a full set of every era of Ronnie Dio's career, and you watch him sing Rainbow, and you watch him sing Sabbath, and you watch him sing the Dio music, and he doesn't miss any notes or anything that Ronnie Dio did, and he's up there singing, and it's just effortless with him. And it's not that it's effortless in the fact that it's easy for him to do. He just makes it seem easy because of how good of a singer he is. Uh-huh. And you know, it's very, very rare, and I'm very lucky to be able to have the opportunity to work with him. I mean, you know, his schedule's a little bit busier than a lot of the people that I've worked with in the past, but I mean, like I said, it could be worse. His voice could be a little bit worse than a lot of the people I worked with in the past, and I'd rather have the guy with the great voice and the busy schedule than the guy with the crappy voice that I could use every day. So.
Right. I'm going to go a little bit off topic here, Chris, and I want to tell you that one of the coolest things I ever saw was you playing with Metal Church, and talk about playing with that band and going on tour with them.
That was a lot of fun. That was something that I was really happy to see Rick's eye heal and him be able to come back and get back with his guys in that band. But if I had to finish that whole entire tour, I would have been more than needed, just because that was so natural for me. It just, you know, kind of felt like I was on stage with Sabotage, you know, during the Gutter Ballet tour sometimes, where you're just playing these clubs and they were packed full of these people and they were just really fun metal songs to play live. I mean, Kurt is such a great writer, and there's so many of the songs that were from the Metal Church history that we didn't even have in that set. You know, ones that were some of the people's favorites, like Metal Church, the song, you know, and mm-hmm. You just think that here we are playing this set that went over that well, and there was these other tunes we could have even done, and then, you know, it's just, it was great music, and for me, it's one of these things that I'll always consider like a really special opportunity I had. And, you know, God bless, like I said, Rick, the fact that his eye is better and he's back, but I had a chance to do that. And it was like the kind of a, it wasn't the same incident, but, you know, with Doro, when Joe decided to leave, and I wound up getting a chance to play with her for about a year before she took Blazin as a permanent member of the band. I mean, that was something that was really special for me too, because, you know, Doro is such an icon and she's such a hard worker. And she would do 14 nights in a row doing a 2-hour set, and she could be sick with the flu or something, and you never knew it. But she just went out there and she gave every bit of her body and her life and her soul to her mm-hmm. fans and her shows. And it was just a privilege for me. I mean, unfortunately, TS so played the month where she did a lot of her touring, because in Europe you do the festivals in the summer, you do your touring in the winter, and you do your touring in the fall into Christmas. So it's like it was impossible for me to be in the band that way, because Doro's very loyal to her band. I mean, she calls the band Doro, but those guys are in every photo with her, and then, you know, they're always represented very well by her, because she really loves her band. And I wasn't able to give that kind of full year commitment to that, you know, not without, you know, leaving my family. And I wasn't going to do that to ESO and Paul. That was my life. So I was very pleased to have the time that I spent with her. But, you know, like I said, it's just part of the legacy. I had an opportunity to play with so many different people throughout my career, and a lot of it's been, you know, really, really special memories to me.
You know, the interesting thing about the Metal Church thing too, Chris, is that, you know, Mike Howe came back and was like spot on. I mean, the man, it didn't even seem like he missed a note, and I was blown away by how great of a vocalist he was.
You know?
Oh yeah, no, his voice was deadly. I mean, it was something that I was on that stage and it was blowing my ears out. I was like, wow, this guy's loud and he's good. And yeah, no, that band was, it was a lot of fun. I mean, you talk about Roy's sense of humor. They got Steve Unger, that guy. He's a character. He's one of the funniest people I've ever worked with. I mean, I had the pleasure of working with Taliva, but Unger is very funny. I mean, he was another one of those ones that he was like addicting when you got out to working with him, just because of how comical it is to be around that guy. Mm-hmm. He's just really, you know, and that's what a lot of times helps make that stuff even better, you know, when the experiences you have with those people personally are that fun, because there are bands I've worked with, I'm not going to bring any of that up, where I've worked with people that are the opposite of fun. And that's what turns this industry sometimes into something that can get very grueling, because you leave home and you're thousands of miles away from your family to deal with people that are really not appreciating what you're doing, and they don't treat you well and they don't treat others well. And you're just kind of in that situation of like, I'd rather be home at this point. And, you know, I've been through those stages in my career too. But, you know, for the most part, I was lucky enough to have, you know, one of the most magical families in the world with O'Neill and the Sabotage guys. So it's like I never had that experience there. It was just kind of, you know, a couple of the other projects and things I'd worked, you know, before Sabotage, you know, when I was out of Sabotage or in the middle where I had some time and got put into some things, you would just have a couple things here and there where you're like, oh, this isn't any fun. And I think that was part of what really made me say no to a lot of the opportunities to do some of these project bands, is just I'd had the experience to play with some things that were just not that much fun, and they weren't worth it, you know, and they weren't worth it in any way, shape, or form.
Now, I know that Sabotage ended up obviously kind of morphing into Trans-Siberian Orchestra, but when you guys did that first record, did you really see it becoming as big as it has?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, it was just something that Paul always knew. I worked with Paul when I was 17, and the whole concept of TSO was something that was coming out of his mouth to me from the very first days I'd known him. He kept talking about, you know, this thing he wanted to do one day where he had this band. He didn't have a name for it at that time, but he said, you know, something that could have limitless singers and different people and play different kinds of music, because Paul always knew, because he was very, very good in this business end of the business as well. He was a manager and producer and worked with a lot of bands and a lot of different musicians, and he would see what would happen to certain musicians and singers as they got older and as they had to sing a lot on the road. And I think that was one of his things with TSO, was that he wanted to make it easier for singers to have a schedule to where they didn't have to sing entire sets. So with having all these vocalists, not only did he get the chance to bring the Broadway and rock theater aspect of his music alive by having different vocalists in the songs, he really was doing all of the singers, you know, a favor to their voices, to where they didn't have to go out and do 8 shows a week of 70 minutes of singing. They were able to go out and do, you know, their few songs and their backgrounds, but everybody was able to take really good care of their voices. And you know, with TSO, Paul, even before we played the very first show, he was just so in tune with where he wanted this thing to go. It was crazy with him. I don't even think we had the first record out yet, and we were trying to do something, and I was discussing the scheduling with him, and he was like, no, you don't get it, Chris. And with TSO Headlines Arenas, I mean, we hadn't even played the first show yet, and he's telling me about when this band goes in Headlines Arenas. I mean, his vision and his work as a visionary in that sense were really so magical, you know. And he said the same thing at a different point as we got further. He said, well, you know, when TSO headlines stadiums, now of course in the wintertime when we play, you're not going to play outdoors, but if you look at a date where West Coast TSO is playing 2 shows in Dallas and we're doing 2 shows in Cleveland, those 4 shows in that day are going over 50,000 people. So it's like TSO got to that level of headlining stadiums on a daily basis. And it's just all these things that he said were going to happen. And it really came out of his vision and his desire to make this thing so special to people and their families and the fans and everybody involved. You know, TSO was a family thing from start to finish, from the management through the band to the people and the crowds, to the people in the venues, to the people and, you know, all the crews and everything that we have. So it's just a really different kind of a special thing that everybody looks forward to every year. It's not an easy thing for people to leave their homes from the beginning of November to New Year's and spend their holidays out on the road. But for TSO, we've developed this family that, you know, people really become very special to each other through working with. And that was Paul, you know. The magic is not gone. I mean, he is always going to be there, and you know, we're living to keep his legacy alive. And you know, we're all who we are, and that thing is what it is because of him. I mean, it's never going to be exactly the same as it was when he was alive, but we're going to do whatever we can to make sure we keep his legacy alive.
I was able to, you know, interview Paul a long time ago, but probably about, I don't know, 16, 17, 18 years ago now. And you worked with him for a very, very long time, almost your entire career. And what are some of your best memories of Paul?
There's like so many different ones. I mean, he was so smart, and he would spend a lot of time reading. We would get into the studio, and on top of the studio desk, you know, when we were always in a really nice big studio with Paul, because he did not, regardless of what happened with technology, Paul wanted to be in like the largest studio, because it was always going to be 1979 with Paul, or 1985. He didn't want things to ever go back to being away from when he started and when bands were in those big studios. But he would have a pile of magazines and a pile of newspapers, and he'd be reading through everything, and I'd be sitting there with Dave Whitman, I'm doing guitar tracks, and sometimes you just don't think that he was paying attention, but he was there through the whole entire thing. And then all of a sudden he'd be speaking to you about some article in there on the history of Russia or whatever it is that's going on, and then out of his mouth, out of nowhere, would be this one note or this squeak on a chord you had that you never even thought he was listening to. So it's like he's paying attention to every tiny little detail of what you're doing while he's sitting there reading out to you as you're trying to play this article on a newspaper. It's like he was just different. He was really unique. And, you know, I remember once I was out in California with him, and he loved to rent Ferraris because he just loved sports cars. He had a couple of the really quick Teslas, and when I was out in a Ferrari with him on one of those throughways out in California, and I just remember being probably the quickest I'd ever been on a street in an automobile in my life. And I'm going, oh God, here we go. But I mean, he was just a great guy. He was the consummate, I think, you know, probably the best boss you ever could have had, because he really just always wanted you to be on this different level. You know, even with Sabotage, when we hadn't gotten to the point where everything was selling out, he was putting us in, you know, the nice buses and nice hotels, and he would make sure that we got onto the road by making sure the rehearsals were done and the hotels were done. And he just got out there, and there might have been situations where some other bands might have said, hey, we're not going to do this, but Paul always made sure we did, and he was always confident in the fact that when we got done with that tour, things were going to be selling out, we were going to be making the money. And he just inspired us, I think, to play on a different level and to live up to this thing and to just work really hard for everything we did. And that's what, you know, it happened with TSO from the very first tour. I mean, that band had a large show the very first time we ever played. And you know, even when the very first time we went to Europe, we were playing in theaters with a show similar to our arena show in the States. And it just, he had this level that he always wanted us to play on and walk at. And, you know, I think that's, you know, something we're always going to continue. You know, it may not be what he is creating exactly because he's physically not there, but, you know, mentally we're always going to take the influence we had, whether it's us musically or Al, you know, putting together songs of the set, or Brian Harley designing light shows, or whatever the case may be. It's always going to be what everybody had gotten working with him, and then making it to where it's going to be that level where he's going to be happy and proud of what we do. And that's it's a great thing to be a part of. You know, it's definitely something that I'm very fortunate to have. And you know, no matter where I am in my life, I'm always going to miss having that guy physically there. You know, and I always tell people that when I usually had problems, it was Paul that I would call, you know, and be like, oh my God, this just happened to this person, or that just happened to this person, or this is happening to me. And then when Paul had passed away, it was kind of like, I can't call Paul. And it was just a different kind of experience.
Now, is there anything else you are going to be working on coming up here, and any other projects or musical things going on in your life?
Well, I'm actually starting to work on the next one of these records, because there is going to be a record too. And then I have my hot sauce stuff that I'm always working on with that company, High River Sauces, and Steve Seabury's, you know, work that we do with that all year long. And then I have my company called Metalfin, which is with that little elephant that I have, Wilbur, where we do art and children's clothing, and I get a lot of money out to children's charities and also to things like, you know, elephant sanctuaries and things like that. So I have a lot of independent things that I do outside of the music things. And I also, there's a very famous rock singer that is going to be doing a record acoustically of a lot of the hit songs and other songs that he had in his band's career that I'm not really going through any of the details on it, but I've been working on a lot of stuff because I think I'm going to be recording a record of that material with him and be doing some shows at the end of the summer, but I'm not going to really announce anything on it until I know it's actually something that's going to be going through. I mean, I've been presented the offer to do it. I'm just trying to work everything out right now. And if it happens, it would be great. If not, I'm having a blast playing the music. So, you know, either way. And, you know, I do some songs with a gentleman named Jimmy Sir, who has an orchestra that won 18 Grammys. And I go out and play rock music with his band. And it's really cool because it's like a really high level orchestra that actually made it throughout Jimmy's career doing polka music. But the band plays a lot of rock and roll songs. And some of the musicians are just great rock singers. And I just go there with them and get a chance to play music. And he's kind of a local guy. He lives in the next town. So it's a way for me to play. He owns his own bus where I can just, you know, hop down the street for a day or two and play a couple shows that are just really fun and gives me a chance to be on the road without being on the road. So it's like, I need to get away from home for a day. It's like, oh, there's Jimmy's got a show today. I'm gone. So it's a little bit different, but time will fly. I'll blink my eyes and it'll be October and I'll be getting ready to pack my stuff and leave for November and December again.
Do you have any shows coming up with these for this Spirits of Fire album?
You know, I really would like to, and I know some festivals have started to hit me up about it. There's not a lot left this year, but Ripper's got the Dio hologram thing going on this summer, so I don't think that we're going to be able to make that match. I think 2020 might be a better hope for that. You know, he's got the Three Tremors thing going on now, so we really didn't have the time to get that done before he had to go work on the Dio stuff, and my dog is barking. But yeah, that's something too, where I think once that record gets out and you get a chance to have the fans get into it and really see where it's going to go, I think that's where the demand level will be able to find that, you know, if we turn around and go, you know, say there's like a spark area for it. It could be Brazil or it could be, you know, somewhere in Greece or something where people just like, you know, we really want to see this band. And then you know, if you get a couple shows here and there, you just start to build from there. And it goes down to everybody's schedule. But for me, I think it would be something that would be really fun. You know, everybody's got a lot of cool albums in their history. And we could put in a few songs here and there from things and do the songs from the record and just make it a lot of fun.
Chris, it was great to have you on the radio show again. And do you have any last words for the fans that are going to be checking out this interview on my show?
You know what? I'm one of the luckiest guys alive, you know, for a lot of reasons besides what has happened in my career. You know, I had some really interesting things happen in my life where I just seem to be lucky. And even last summer, a lot of people don't know about it, but I had a crazy accident that happened. It was like a reason why I wasn't able to play with Doro in September. I got something that gave me a really bad brain injury last summer. And it's like, I have been lucky enough to make it through some of the things that, you know, a lot of people that I knew didn't, you know, some things that happened with my friends that have gotten in accidents where they didn't make it. So it's like, you know, I'm a really lucky person as far as how my careers went. And that is because of the fans, you know, and you see it from a lot of the bands out there, and most of them, they're exactly on it. When you see Gene and Paul talking about that Kiss tour and they're talking about how they wouldn't be there without the fans. And it's like, you know, a lot of what I've done, you know, besides obviously Paul, I mean, you know, we wouldn't be where we were without the fans. The fans are always very important to us, and you know, keeping them happy and them being able to keep us doing what we're doing, it's a fortunate thing. I mean, I've had a very long career and you know, it's still continuing. And like I said, I consider myself one of the luckiest guys in the world a lot of times, and I'm just going to keep working. And you know, I'm not the most perfect person in the world, but as time goes on, I've learn to just do what I can to make people happy and to try to make myself a better person and try to make myself as good a musician as I could be.